Blog Talk Radio.
You ready?
It's time to start.
This should be played at high volume.
This is the Andrea Shea Game Show.
And I'm just a gal like any other gal.
That's cool.
You know what this is.
What is this?
The Andrea Shea Game Show.
It's me, don't you remember?
We were just talking about you.
Totally amazing.
Thank you.
The Andrea Shea Game Show.
I think you've got something there.
Andrea Shea King.
You're really going to like it.
Quite understandable.
Is on the air.
Something's definitely going on here.
Take my word for it.
Now.
Come on.
Barack Obama has lived almost 50 years without leaving.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the program. It's nice to have you with me this evening, and it appears that I have I just signed on for the premium program with Blog Talk Radio, and I'm not sure if I'm doing things correctly, but welcome to the program this evening, everybody. Nice to have you with me. I was about to play for you audio from Peter Boyle's show today. Let me see if I can get that to play for you
Barack
again.
Barack Obama has lived almost 50 years without leaving any footprints. None. There is no Obama documentation. There's no bona fides. There's no paper trail. There's nothing. The original so-called vault copy birth certificate's never been released. Lawyers' fees are estimated above $200,000 on this. A birth certificate is $15. The certification of live birth that has been released is counterfeited. It's amended. The certification of live birth was released. That's also counterfeited an amendment. Obama-Dunham marriage license doesn't even exist. Obama-Dunham divorce decree was released, but it's laughable because they were never married. How can you divorce someone you never married? The Neolani kindergarten records, suppressed. Saturo Dunham marriage license has never been released. Saturo adoption records have not been released. Franciscus Assisi school application was released by Jerry Corsi. Panhu school applications, missing. Panhu school records, not released. Neolani third grade records, not released, but then there's that weird picture. Selective service registration, social security numbers released, state of Connecticut. Occidental College records not released, financial aid not released, passport not released, records were scrubbed by Obama's terrorism and intelligence advisor. Columbia College records not released, Harvard College records not released, Illinois bar records not released, baptism certificates not released, medical records not released, and it goes on. Hang on.
Don't even try to understand. You find a place to make your stand. Take it easy.
Now, that was Peter Boyles of KHOW. To our regular listeners, you might recall that on Tuesday night we played a segment of Peter Boyles' show in which he interviewed Dr. Jerry Corsi about Obama's refusal to release any of his records. Tuesday night's show is archived, so you can listen to it if you're interested. And good evening, fellow patriots, and thanks for joining us tonight. The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to hear oral arguments in a number of cases brought before it on the question of Obama's eligibility to hold the office of president under Article 2, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution. Associate Justice Clarence Thomas admitted in a congressional hearing earlier this year that the Supreme Court is, and I quote, evading the issue. Well, on the 14th, 15th, and 16th of this month, December 2010, retired U.S. Naval Commander Charles Kirshner was an eyewitness to a judicial lynching at the trial of a U.S. Army lieutenant colonel who has served for 18 years in uniform as a military physician, a flight surgeon to General George Casey's unit. Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin had in the past deployed to Afghanistan and Bosnia in a war situation. This month, Lieutenant Colonel Lakin was found guilty of disobeying orders and missing movement after he announced last March that he could no longer follow orders because of his doubts about and lack of evidence of Obama's constitutional eligibility to act as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. military. Lieutenant Colonel Lakin's trial took place at Fort Meade in Maryland, and in the view of many, the trial was a sham, a judicial lynching. Lieutenant Colonel Lakin now sits in a cell at Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary, where he was ordered to serve a six-month sentence. He's been stripped of his rank, his pay, and his benefits. Commander Kirshner has been a guest on this program several times, along with his attorney, Mario Apuzzo, to discuss a lawsuit that they had brought, in which they also demanded that Obama produce proof that he did indeed fulfill the requirements to hold the office of president. That case, along with every other case that has been brought seeking the truth about Obama's past, was thrown out without comment. It's been reported that Obama has spent approximately $2 million in legal fees to prevent his records from seeing the light of day. Since his lawsuit, Commander Kirshner has turned his attention to Lieutenant Colonel Lakin's case. Commander Kirshner, a man who takes seriously his oath to defend and protect the Constitution, who walks the talk and puts it all on the line, as has Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin, is with us tonight to talk about his case and the travesty of justice that has been perpetrated upon Terry Lakin and, by default, every other service member who is taking orders from a commander-in-chief who refuses to prove he is not a usurper. Commander Kirshner, thanks for joining us again this evening, and welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
It's nice to have you back again. Commander Kirshner, I thought maybe we would start first with you explaining to our listeners about your case before we move on to that of Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin.
Well, and I've been watching Obama, tracking and seeing, trying to find out who he is since early 2008, and blogging actively since last week in July of 2008. And increasingly, the more I investigated the man, the less I knew. His whole identity is an enigma. But by January of 2009, seeing that the press didn't vet him, the DNC didn't really vet him, the voters not having the real knowledge about him, of course, elected him. And the Electoral College, most of them were hamstrung to have to vote the way the popular vote was. They didn't vet him. The joint session of Congress didn't vet him. And I had written dozens and dozens and dozens of letters to various senators and representatives asking them to investigate. Wrote to the president, Secretary of Homeland Security, vice president. None of them even answered my letters. So at that point, I just felt that I had to do something. I just couldn't keep just sitting by and do nothing. I decided to bring a lawsuit after the joint session confirmed him and before he was sworn in. And I looked for an attorney and found Mario Apuzzo and retained him. He worked on a pro bono basis. And I found some other, through the help of some volunteers, some other co-plaintiffs. And we brought the lawsuit in January 2009. And the last 23 months, it's worked its way through the court system, and at every level of the court system, they declined to hear the case on the basis of standing, and no citizen has a right under the Constitution, even the Ninth Amendment, to defend the Constitution. In other words, we're supposed to have unalienable rights, due process, and the rights of equal protection, because they investigated McCain at the request of the citizens, but they didn't investigate Obama. And in addition to my lawsuit suing Obama, I also sued Congress, by the way, and Nancy Pelosi and Dick Cheney, because they fraudulently and illegally handled the joint session, not calling for the objections from each and every state. There were numerous charges, but anyway, it finally worked its way up to the Supreme Court in September 2010, and my petition was sent to them on the 30th of September, and they just denied to hear it, no comment. And we had asked that the two Supreme Court justices, Kagan and Sotomayor, recuse themselves because an obvious conflict of interest, not even the appearance of a conflict of interest, because their very jobs depended on the legitimacy of the president, the putative President Obama, to make the appointments. And their salary, their whole career, their whole livelihood on that bench was on the line with my case. So first, they should have accused themselves, but they didn't. And I think there was a reason. And the reason is with nine justices conferencing on whether to take a petition and go forward to a hearing, you need four to move forward and five to win in the hearing. And with seven, if those two were to recuse themselves, you only needed three to move forward, you know, the one less than a majority, and four to win the case. And I think they didn't recuse themselves because they knew or suspected that there could be three justices that would have voted to take my petition and grant a hearing on it. So to guarantee it didn't get out of conference, I believe they voted to be in there to make sure it didn't get out of conference by requiring the rule of four instead of the rule of three, and also to be able to argue against taking it in conference. The conferences are held in secret, so we'll never know. But they should have recused themselves in a case immediately before mine on the orders list and immediately after mine. Kagan recused himself in one of them and Sotomayor in the other. So, and it was the orders list was full of recusals by those two because they have many, many conflicts. And in my case, they didn't recuse themselves, and they should have. They had a direct – we cited the regulations in the federal court system that deal with ethics and recusals, and they clearly should have recused themselves. But they chose not to. They chose the unethical stand to vote and hear this in conference and obviously I don't know if they voted against it or not because it's all secret, but they didn't get four votes to go forward, and I'm sure those two didn't vote to hear the case. I mean, obviously they are.
It certainly seems that they gave themselves an excuse by not recusing themselves at that point.
Well, the old story, if the case is, quote, a loser or a dog of a case, why would you put your ethical reputation on the line and not recuse yourself? I believe the talk around the Supreme Court has been for a long time that there's been two or three justices that wanted to take the cases, but they never could get four. Now, here was a case where it was seven, they only needed three. So I believe that they knew this and that they didn't recuse themselves because they knew they had to keep the rule of four in play and not let it slip to rule of three.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you make of Associate Justice Clarence Thomas stating in earlier this year in a congressional hearing that the Supreme Court is evading the issue?
Well, I believe that means that in some of these conferences and some of the prior cases, which if it could be a fly on the wall in there, you would have heard them arguing, a few of them arguing, or two or three of them arguing, to take this case. This is a constitutional issue, and we've got to decide this. But they never could get to four. See? So I personally think Chief Justice Roberts has been the holdout on the, quote, conservative side of the court, and he's been the one
what
keeping
makes you
us
think
in...
so? What makes
I
you
just,
think it's Roberts?
It's just an instinct or a gut feeling that he's the collegial guy that was quite friendly to Obama, and that meeting prior to the inauguration of Obama, was it right after the inauguration, where they were meeting in the conference room there, and I think Alito clearly would have been a vote for the Constitution to hear it, and I think Thomas was. I think Scalia was too. And if I had to pick of where I was going to get the three votes for sure, I would have picked Alito, Thomas, and Scalia. And Roberts was just a question mark in my mind. And I think he's always been the holdout on the fourth vote. Now, with seven there, you only need three. And I think that's why the other two justices appointed by Obama didn't recuse themselves. If they knew the case was going to go down because they couldn't get three, they wouldn't have bothered to sit in the conference. They would have recused themselves. It's just, if you look at the rules of the court, there was a reason they chose to take the unethical posture of not recusing themselves. There had to be a reason, and I think the reason was the law clerks talked to each other in the Supreme Court. And I think that the word was around that there were three justices leaning to vote for this petition of Kirchner versus Obama in Congress. Why else would two justices sully their reputation with an obvious conflict of interest and not recuse themselves if they were not needed to defeat the case in conference?
And you went in there very confident. You and your attorney, Mario Puzo, went into this very confident that you had a case, you were bringing forward a case that with arguments that nobody else had made. And so as a result, you felt like going into it that you probably had a better chance than anybody had of getting this case heard or at least considered by the Supreme Court.
Well, the case was brought at a judicially ripe time after the political process was done. That is, the joint session had confirmed, illegally in my opinion, confirmed the Obama, and prior to him being sworn in. So we were suing the president-elect, a private person at that point, and we felt the DOJ shouldn't have been defending him in the first place. He should have been using his private lawyers. He didn't. But anyway, it was filed at a judicially ripe time. They were always saying, before you were suing the Secretary of the State, that's a ministerial, or you were suing prior the election was over, so it's moot, he may not win the election, or it's not moot, premature, he may not win the election. And if you sued him after he took office, then they would say to you, like they did in one of the Tate's cases, you should have filed this before he was sworn in. So, in other words, other people didn't include Congress, so they said, well, Congress is the culprit here, and Congress is not before. So we had everything covered in the arguments, and we also brought in the fact that McCain was given a hearing, and and Obama was not at the request of the people. That's unequal protection under the law, and lack of due process. So, and the fact that I had written all these letters and not received even an answer, but we argued this case very well. My attorney was very, very well laid out case all the way up through the federal system, and we didn't skip any steps. Some other cases skipped the appeal process, the appeals court in the circuit, and went directly to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court just threw it right back down and said, no, you can't skip the steps. You see, so we did everything right all the way up, and I, in my heart, still believe the Supreme Court was not corrupted or rotted from the inside out. I thought if they got the proper case, and we gave them the proper case, based on the fact that he was not a natural-born citizen because his father was not a U.S. citizen. And we also argued on the fact that he has not conclusively proven he was born in Hawaii because being born in the USA is a necessary but not sufficient condition to be a natural-born citizen. He had to be born in a country of two U.S. citizens. And his father was not a U.S. citizen, not an immigrant, not even a legal permanent resident in the United States. He didn't even have a green card. He was here on a student visa. So I thought that if we got the right case to the Supreme Court, we'd be heard. But I was wrong, and I was particularly encouraged when we believed that the two justices would recuse themselves and we'd be dealing with seven, and therefore needed only three to go forward. But the ethics were thrown aside, and the two justices voted anyway, and the rule of four stayed in place, and it's the same old story, in my opinion. I'm looking at all the facts over time. We just cannot get the four votes in that Supreme Court because I think Chief Justice Roberts is the holdout on the conservative side. They're all afraid of the potential for violence if his constitutional eligibility would be vetted, that somehow certain minority groups would riot and cause trouble and, civil unrest. I never believed that. That's an insult to the minorities of this country, that if the Constitution was being upheld and the Supreme Court said that he was, and they vetted him, and they said that the definition of natural-born citizen is that both parents have to be citizens and be born in the country, and obviously his father isn't, so therefore he's not ineligible. If the rule of the Constitution is the glue that held this country together, I believe very few people would have been, causing trouble on purpose, and the rule of law would have applied. And instead, we have a situation where the rule of law is totally gone. We're not, this Constitution has been made meaningless by the Supreme Court refusing to do its job. And we're headed probably for an even worse situation in this country than would have happened if the rule of law would have been applied early on, you know, right in the primary. I mean, some people would have been upset if he was disqualified, but that's what the Constitution, the eligibility clause is, and it should have been applied.
Yeah, yeah. Now, concurrent with your case went before the Supreme Court. In what month was it?
September 30th of 2010, that's when it was submitted, and then it got put on the docket, and then let's see, by November, they had 30 days for the other side to reply, and they chose not to reply, and then on November 22nd, in private conference, there's nobody in there, no notes, anything, they decided the case, petition, whether they're going to hear it or not, but we didn't learn until the orders came out on the 29th. And on the 29th, we learned it was denied with no comment.
Okay, so
they don't have to give a reason.
That,
pardon?
Pardon me? Yeah, I didn't hear what you just said.
I said it was denied with no comment. They don't have to give a reason. They just said denied.
Right. Well, concurrent now with that was also the trial of Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin. And we know...
He was inside the military pursuing the same question.
Mm-hmm. And when did you become aware Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin's case?
I think it was around March that I learned that a doctor in the military was a lieutenant colonel and doctor was questioning the constitutional eligibility. It's March of 2010. Questioning the eligibility of the president, and that he was. Frustrated and was unable to get answers. I didn't know all the details of how much he was trying to get answers until the actual trial a couple weeks ago. But I did learn that he was frustrated to the point he was going to disobey orders of the 30,000-man surge to go to Afghanistan, which comes – see, when to deploy troops in a foreign country, especially in time of war, the president must sign off on those orders. I mean, they can move troops around inside the United States all they want, the Pentagon can or whatever. The president doesn't get involved with that. But when you deploy troops to a foreign war zone, and like you remember at the speech at West Point, the president was talking, he's going to increase the troops in Afghanistan, the 30,000 men were going to be surged over there. And he signed off on which units would be sent over there, and Lieutenant Colonel Lakin was going to be sent over there as one of those units. So this was a direct order coming down from a putative president that Lakin and I, too, believe is illegal. So he decided he's not going to obey that order because his prime directive is support and defend the Constitution. That's his oath. And he didn't believe Obama was legal under the Constitution and that therefore the orders he was issuing were unlawful. Unlawful as being judged against the Constitution. So that's when I heard about it.
And he's not the only military man, active duty, who has challenged Obama. I believe Major Stephen Cook was also one of the military who challenged it. Correct?
Correct. But that was one of the plaintiffs that, or defendant, I guess, that Orley Tates had. Anyway, they dealt with him simply by canceling his orders. And he'd also lose his job as a result of that. They used some dirty tricks in the background after he got his orders canceled. The civilian employer had contracts with the military, and they said, "Well, if you keep this guy in your payroll, you're not going to get any more contracts."
Yeah. Obviously, this is a big conspiracy, a cabal, to prevent Obama's record from being shown to the American people. So
plan. The conspiracy word is loaded. It's a plan. They have a plan. They had a plan to put this man in office. It's been in the works for many, many years, and it's a plan to keep him there. And he's not legally eligible for the office.
When you found out about Lieutenant Colonel Lakin and your case was dismissed, how did you get involved with Lieutenant Colonel Lakin's case?
Well, I had my own case, and I was 110% involved with that, and I wasn't really paying a lot of attention to his case other than just following it in the news. I had deliberately tried to stay out of other cases on purpose. It was a tactical, strategic decision of mine to prosecute my case and stay out of the other cases. But after my case lost, I guess I got to go back to the original beginning. I felt called to bring forward my lawsuit. I felt I was like in turmoil for 2 weeks before I did it, because I felt I was being called to do this. That no, you know, somebody's got to do something. You just can't let all the other cases have gone down the drain. Somebody's got to step forward. And when I filed it, after that, all that torment went away. I felt at peace that I was doing something. And but again, after my case was denied, I saw Lieutenant Colonel Lakin going to court-martial down there. I just felt like a fellow soldier. Rhetorically, I was in the Navy. He was a soldier. I just felt, again, I called that I had to go down there and do my best to try to help him. So that's what I did. When my case was denied, I let him know that I would be available to his advisor. I never spoke to him directly. I never met him until I got down to the court-martial. But that I would be willing to come down and do what I can to speak out to help him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what
mm-hmm.
I did. I a friend of mine helped do the driving, and we drove down to Fort Meade and to observe and also to speak out if the opportunity presented us to the media down there, the travesty of this whole thing, that he was living up to his oath and risking everything, and he was denied discovery in the preliminary hearing in September, denied the ability to call witnesses to validate his beliefs in the oath, and that the oath is the prime directive, and the chain of command goes all the way back to the president, doesn't stop with the Pentagon like Judge Lynn tried to. That Judge Lynn determined that the orders came from the Pentagon and didn't go back to the president as far as deployment. That's false. The deployment orders for foreign deployment go back to the president. All authority in the military comes down from the president. Even the authority of that convening court-martial comes down through the chain of command from the president. But he would not allow to present any evidence about the chain of command going back to the president and discovery of documents. And even worse, that at that preliminary hearing, Judge Lynn declared that the orders he disobeyed are presumed legal. So, in other words, when he went into the actual court-martial, they were told, the panelists were told, that the orders he disobeyed were presumed legal, when if the whole basis of the orders were unconstitutional, that was the question. Are they really legal? Because
right.
he's a putative president who wasn't constitutionally eligible to sit in the office and give those orders. So when you get to the court martial and you're told the orders are presumed legal, the panel has to accept that fact stated by the judge. How in the world can he win?
You can't.
Because his argument was that the orders were not legal in the first place to go to be deployed to Afghanistan. So
right. They cut him off at the pass.
It was a kangaroo court. When he got to the court martial, it was a kangaroo court. I mean, there's no way anybody could have walked out of there without going to jail, because the judge decided the preliminary hearing, no discovery, no witnesses as to the facts of the merits of what he was arguing, of living up to his oath as being the prime directive, and he wanted the question answered: is Obama eligible under the Constitution, therefore his orders are lawful, or is he not? And she said, you're not going to get even a chance to investigate or ask those questions, and we're just going to declare the orders are presumed legal. Presumed legal. Presumed. So are we fighting a presumed war with presumed bullets? I mean, presumed legal. That was the legality of the questions was the whole basis of why he questioned the order.
Yeah. Let's take it from the top here. You said that you and a friend drove down to Fort Meade to be there for the trial.
A friend who was a combat veteran of Vietnam, by the way. He was he had the bullets flying around him over there. I never got over there myself,
wow.
But he drove a tracked vehicle in the rice paddies.
So
he'd seen action,
so,
and he was standing up for his country too to support Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin. He wanted to go down there and show his support for him too.
When you arrived, when you first arrived, you were checking in to see if there was any military housing available for you.
That's right.
Tell us what happened
I believe the hand of God is involved here. It's just too much to be all a coincidence, because here we drive a couple hundred miles down to the Fort Meade, and you know, we stop along the way and, you know, have something to eat and whatever. We get there, we can't find the building. We're driving around. We finally figure out where the check-in building is, and we go in there. And at the exact instant I'm going in there, I declared my name. He got my ID card out, and I said that I had called down and make reservations, but they said they weren't taking reservations. But if you showed up around 4 o'clock, we'd be able to give you a room if there was one available. I just walked in with my ID, Commander Kretschner, just told them exactly what I just told you. No, there weren't any rooms. But just at that exact instant in time, a gentleman was leaving the building, and he heard me say, "Commander Kretschner, and I'm looking for, you know, here to see if there's a room." And he stopped over there, and after I turned around with my friend to walk out, he says to me, "Commander Kretschner." And I said, "Yes." And I looked at him, and I recognized him. I said, "Terry." There he was. Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin was checking out of that building. Wherever he was staying at the base, I don't know, but that's the building where you check in and check out. It was like the central booking building. At the exact instant in time that I'm trying to get a room, here's two people, our paths just cross in the universe. And we are the two people who have the most recent high-profile cases suing the, you know, like dealing with the president's eligibility. If I would have arrived a couple minutes sooner or a couple minutes later, I would have never met him. It was just how bizarre. You know, if I wouldn't have stopped on the way down to have a little bite to eat, or if I'd have been able to find a building immediately, because, say, the gate guard would have given me great directions. It's just that everything stacked up, and I just walk in there, say my name, and he happens to be leaving the building, and he hears my name and stops and waits for me and introduces himself, and he says, "It's an honor to meet me." And I said, "It's an honor to meet me? It's an honor to meet you. You're the one risking everything, you know, and we came down here to support you." I introduced my friend, and we were talking there a bit, and he said, "I think we better step outside, because the gentleman who helped us find the building had come in to show us he turned out to be on the court martial panel the next day, and Terry had sort of detected that he probably was, and he thought we should step outside and go in his car and talk, so that there wouldn't be any danger of impropriety there or whatever. So we went out in his car. He turned the car on in the heat, you know, and we're sitting there and we're chit-chatting, and again, he's pleased to meet me and honored to meet me, and I'm telling him I'm honored to meet you. You're the one risking everything. And somewhere in there, he says, you know, "Did you guys eat yet? Why don't you come out to my house, you know, and we can talk more out there." So we didn't want to impose, because it's the day before the trial. We thought he had things to do, and against of getting ready for the trial, maybe speak with his lawyer or whatever. So he finally insisted, so we said, "Okay, we'll come out." So we went to get our commercial lodging taken care of, and as soon as we did that, off-base lodging, because there wasn't anything on the base, we then went out to Terry's house, and he lived about 35 miles from the base, and we met him and his family and talked about the pending court martial, and he was upbeat, and still he knew he would be punished because the deck was stacked against him, but he wasn't defeated. He said he still believed in the Constitution, and that he thinks he did the right thing, and maybe a couple the steps were made legally in the sense of the order to report to the commanding officer for counseling. In hindsight, he probably should have obeyed that order, because that one didn't go back to the president. It's the one about being deployed that did. But he kind of maybe misunderstood his initial counselor's advice, and so he knew he had made a few mistakes tactically along the way. But he was still upbeat and optimistic. So they're like the hand of God was there, and that we met accidentally. I'd never met him before, never spoken to him on the phone, never had emailed him at all. It's just bizarre. There I go down to support him, and I run into him on the base. And that's a huge base. I don't know. It's about 5,000 acres.
Right.
Many,
well,
many
that's
buildings.
Called a divine appointment.
Yes.
Yeah, a divine appointment. So you met him. You had a chance to sit in his home with him and get to know him and his wife. He was upbeat. He was optimistic. He was realistic
children.
About what he was facing.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
Three young
children,
his beautiful children. I have grandkids about the same age. And it was a beautiful family, small, middle-class home in the suburbs. And his wife's supportive of his decision. And everything was looked fine, and we knew there were going to be difficulties the next day. I kind of thought he detected that he might not be dismissed from the Army because he thought his new attorney was pretty sharp, and but he would get punished for some of the things he did and have to do some time in prison for it maybe or whatever. But he was still upbeat.
So when you left his house that evening, it was with a sense that, things were going to be not go smoothly the following day, but they would at least go fairly. Maybe.
Right. He thought that he had a chance of getting across the message of why he did this and that he still believed in the Constitution and what he did. And we felt like kindred souls talking to each other. We talked for about 2.5 hours. Him and my friend and his wife and him and the kids were all aware of what their daddy was standing up for. I tried to not talk in front of the kids, and I said at one point, do the kids know what's happening? Oh, yeah, they do. So
how old are the children?
Well, let's see now, about, what's sixth grade? How old would a girl be in sixth grade?
Probably about 10 or 11 years old.
10
maybe.
Or 11, yeah. And then there was another one about, I would say, 8 or 7, and another one about 2. So maybe 2 or 3. But they're nice kids, Christian home. Terry is a very devout, low-key, calm, quiet type person. They got pizza. We had a little, they treated us all the pizza there and a little wine and pizza. And with 2.5 hours, we kibitzed a little bit there about everything. And like I say, it was like kindred souls talking to each other. We both knew we believed in God. We believed in the oath at the end, and he'd say, so help me God. We both believed that we were living up to the oath to the best of our ability, so help us God. We didn't take our oath as just words. Like I guess some people think it's a ritual. You just, do this ritual and say these words as part of whatever, being a senator or joining the military. It doesn't mean anything after that. That's what some people think. Both of Terry and I take that oath seriously, different, and we could tell that.
Yes, yes. All right. So take us to the following morning when you arrive at the court martial. Tell, paint a word picture for us. What did you see when you arrived?
Well, we arrived very early. It was very cold and windy, and they wouldn't let anybody in the building early, so there was a line there, and everybody's freezing cold, And they waited till it was 8:30. They opened the doors, I believe, and the court martial started at 9. So we're all there shivering and, open the door, let us come in and get warmed up. But they finally opened up the doors, and we had to go through the metal detectors and the wands and stand a certain way, just like the airport drills that are doing right now. You stand with your hands out. They were the military police there, or court bailiffs, whatever they were, and security. There were police cars everywhere. They had half the parking lot blocked off, so you couldn't bring any vehicles close to the entrance of the court. I don't know what they were thinking. Like somebody would, whatever. I mean, some soldier told the one person that they were told that we could be potentially violent. I mean, we're peace-loving, constitutional people. It's the other side that's been always the one introducing violence into this issue, as exemplified by the service employment union goons beating up people at the town hall meeting, last August, but a year before this past August. But anyway, they were very apprehensive of us, and we all got in there eventually. And I looked around the courtroom. I wanted to figure out it was full, it was packed. So I said, I wonder how many people are here. So I counted all the seats. There was 60. All right. There was and it was declared by the court security, the bailiffs, or what do you want to call them, the military uniforms, that they were going to admit any other people on a standing room only basis. And there were people standing around the walls. In most cases, the military got up and gave the seats to people who wanted to sit down. But there also was a closed-circuit camera to feed to another room. And so I don't know how many people were in the other room the first day, if there were any, or if that was full. I don't know. There was also press outside that never got into the room. They were out there. I saw them at lunchtime. They were freezing. But so the room was packed, and at 9 o'clock, it's the, all rise, and the judge comes in. So we quickly learned before that there were a few of the classic O-butts there, too. There was maybe about three or four of them, and two for sure. But the vast majority of the people were the patriots there to support Lakin.
Mm-hmm. So then what happened? Also, I noted that Reverend Manning was there as well. And
He didn't get there the first day. Reverend Manning came there the second day. I believe it was either the first day in the afternoon or the second day. I'd have to check my notes just exactly. He wasn't there in the morning, though. But anyway, that was it was interesting. Okay, well, let's go through the trial here a little bit. So they all rise, and we learn that Mr. Puckett is speaking that Terry was going to plead guilty to the first count of disobeying orders. Basically, the charges are broken down of disobeying orders as one count and missing movement as the other. And the disobeying orders part, he was going to plead guilty to. So I think what happened is that Terry kind of knew there was going to be some kind of plea bargaining or whatever you want to talk about, but he didn't know the extent of things. And I think he probably didn't meet a lot with Neil prior to the actual trial starting. Probably Terry go in earlier. They left him in, but the other people had to stand out in the cold. But they left him in because he's part of the court process, So the lawyers got in, and the judges and the bailiffs and all that. So he was in there. He was probably meeting with his lawyer, and I get the feeling after the fact that Neil Puckett didn't spend a lot of time briefing his client as to what was going to happen until the actual day of the events. But anyway, they decided to plead guilty to the disobeying orders, and the rest of the morning was spent basically for hours. The judge kept going over with Terry, do you know what you're doing? Do you agree with this? It's sort of like the Miranda rights. Are you giving up all your rights to a defense here on these charges of disobeying orders? Do you fully understand this? Do you know that the maximum penalty could be 18 months in prison? So that was the whole morning, going over all the details of pleading guilty to those charges. So at that point, they go then to the next count, which is missing movement, which they pleaded not guilty to. And then of course you got to get into the voir dire part. They bring in the panel then, and they had 10, and they asked them a bunch of questions and eliminated two of them, and then they started the court martial. The prosecution put on their case, and that was the rest of the day. And they made, of course, Lieutenant Colonel Lakin look like the worst soldier that ever served in the Army. That was the end of the day. The prosecution rested their case. So if you have any specific questions about what went on in the prosecution's case, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, I want to know, the prosecution, did they, were they, first of all, were these seasoned JAG officers or
no, they were how, they were more junior. The original JAG officer that was assigned to Lieutenant Colonel Lakin's prosecution, as you may remember, in the preliminary hearing, he at one point had told one of the constables or bailiffs there that that if Terry doesn't behave himself, taser him. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Yeah, that guy was removed from the team. He was, the lead prosecutor. I think he was a major, but I'm not positive, or a lieutenant colonel. But he was removed from the case because of that, and I understand he got some sort of disciplinary action, a letter or something in his file, but I heard down there at the trial that he has decided to leave the military. So the original prosecutor was off the case, and the new team were all younger people. I believe it was a captain and maybe one very young major, two males and one female. And we didn't think they were doing a very good job because we thought that Neil Puckett was going to – they didn't address the Constitution at all as far as why Lieutenant Colonel Lakin, after 18 years of honorable and exemplary service, would refuse an order to deploy to Afghanistan when he'd been there before and he'd been to Bosnia and combat zone and been decorated. So we thought that, well, they can do all they want, but Neil Puckett's a very experienced lawyer, and he's gonna basically clean their clocks.
Bring that out.
In the defense section. But boy, were we surprised about Neil. I mean, when the prosecution rested at the end of the first day, they had basically called a whole bunch of witnesses, including the commanding officer, to just testify to the fact that that Terry was spoke to report to Fort Campbell that he had acquired plane tickets to go down there, and then he didn't show up for the plane. And that was the basis of missing movement. But he also, in his orders, could have driven down there by a privately owned vehicle. So when the cross-examination, Neil kept hitting on this, that just because he didn't take that plane, he didn't miss the movement of the unit, of the military unit. He just missed flying down a plane, and he could have also drove down or taken a bus down. So it was a legal technicality type defense that he had the option of getting any way he, on his orders, any way he could to get to Fort Campbell. So the charge for missing movement by not being on that plane was not legal. But in the end, they convicted of him anyway. But that was the prosecution was trying to show that he had a duty to be on that plane. And the cross-examination was, well, he didn't have a duty to be on that plane. He had a duty to report to Fort Campbell. He just disobeyed orders to report to Fort Campbell, and he already pleaded guilty to that. He didn't have a duty to be on that plane because he could have, if he was going to report to Fort Campbell, he could have drove down with a private vehicle because that was allowed under his orders, or he could have taken a bus. So the missing movement charge was piling on by the government. They already got him to plead guilty to disobeying orders, and he did that because he was telling the truth, because he did disobey the orders, and he had no way of defending himself as to the reason why. They would not allow discovery or witnesses, and they had the judge said to Lakin's attorney and to everybody that was in the panel or in the courtroom that the orders are presumed legal. You know, so in that case, if the orders are presumed legal, he disobeyed them. So he pleaded guilty to that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And we're talking with Commander Charles Kirshner, U.S. Navy retired, who himself had brought a case challenging Obama's records, and it wasn't heard. Went all the way to the Supreme Court, and attended the court martial of Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin, who now sits in a cell at Fort Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. Commander Kirshner, Terry Lakin had two attorneys. He had a civil attorney to begin with, Paul Jensen.
Right.
What was the story with that? Why was he removed from the case?
Well, all I know is what I heard. I don't really know why for sure, but when the preliminary hearing, when all means of defense were removed, the ability to gain discovery of documents, to call witnesses, to defend Lieutenant Colonel Lakin's decision to consider the officer's oath his prime directive, and to judge all orders as to whether they're lawful against the Constitution, which is a fundamental law of our land. It's not just a piece of parchment paper on display in Washington. That's the fundamental law of our land, and all orders, a military officer is supposed to be able to have the intelligence to question whether the order is lawful against criminal law, but also the constitutional law of the land. If an order is unconstitutional, you're not supposed to obey it. That support and defend the Constitution is the only thing you're required to do by oath. But anyway, once Jensen was not able to get discovery or be able to call witnesses or put up any kind of defense at all on a constitutional basis, it was strictly a matter of mitigating damages in the use under the UCMJ as to how much time he was going to be able to do be sentenced to. And with the judge saying that the orders are declared presumed legal, at that point, I believe Terry Lakin and his advisors decided that it was best to get a UCMJ expert at this point to try to mitigate the amount of time he would be spending in prison. And Paul Jensen has no experience at all that I know with a military law. So at some point, a decision was made to hire another attorney who was a UCMJ expert. Now, I would have thought Paul Jensen could have stayed in as part of the team, but whatever reason, he didn't. But now the question I have in my mind is, how did they get to Neil Puckett? Like the two balls, the balls in motion, or the people in motion, the universe, that Terry and I met there accidentally at the Fort Meade lodging building. Who introduced him to Neil Puckett, and how did that come about? In other words, I heard it was at some sort of a fundraising dinner, and that Neil was introduced to Terry, or Terry was introduced to Neil, and on the basis that Neil's is high-powered, very successful, very well-known military law attorney, and maybe he can help you. He can really do a much better job than Paul Jensen on this, because it's now military law that's the prime concern here, and the constitutional issues were not going to be allowed. So, was that an accident? Was that a coincidence? Was it arranged? Who arranged it? I wondered about that after I saw how the case ended, because when we get to the second day after the defense, after the prosecution arrested on the first day, the second day we get to the defense. The first thing Neil does is rest. He doesn't even put up a defense.
He rested the defense?
Yes, he rested.
What a shock that must have been!
Right, everybody in the audience was like, looking around, whoa, well, rest? No defense at all.
What did Lieutenant Colonel Lakin do at that moment? Did he appear surprised?
I think he was briefed about this by Neil Puckett, that this is what we're going to do, and we're going to make all our arguments during the sentencing phase as to why you did this and everything. But if you know Lieutenant Colonel Lakin, he's a very humble guy. He was very unexpressive through the whole trial. He just sat there,
kind
only
of
answered
meek.
Questions.
Would you characterize him as meek?
Yeah. He's a nurturer. He's a doctor. The military is. You look at the military, you think of warriors. Well, you know, certain people are alpha male warriors, but he's a doctor. He's not there to charge up the hill with a bayonet. He's there to fix up the wounds after you've been injured charging up the hill. You know, he's a nurturing, kind, gentle man. He's a doctor. and a very experienced doctor with expertise in three specialties. But anyway, so he just sat there and took all this, and I think that's part of the problem when Neil Puckett put him on the stand in the sentencing phase. He just decimated this man because this man, he's not a forceful person in a physical intimidation type situation that Neil Puckett presented to him, not physical intimidation, verbal intimidation, but very forceful, called interrogation of him during the sentencing phase. He just broke Lieutenant Colonel Lakin because Lieutenant Colonel Lakin is a very quiet, humble man. He's very strong in his convictions, but yet in his outward demeanor, he's not a very forceful, assertive person. Like, I can't describe it. I don't know if you know what I mean.
Yeah. He's mild-mannered.
Yeah, very humble. Very humble.
Yeah.
He'll do anything for his soldiers. It was testified in the sentencing phase and his character witnesses that he would take his spare time over in Afghanistan, and he was trained in as an osteopath, so he was trained in manipulation and massage, and these pilots of these helicopters would come back from action and they'd be all tensed up, and he would, even though he was off duty, he would have his massage table there and give these people an osteopathic type relaxation type massage to reduce their stress. So, but anyway, the defense rested. It just shocked us.
Yeah. Well, before we get to that, I want to ask you: did the eligibility question ever come up at all?
Only the prosecution showed the videotape that Safeguard Our Constitution put up, you know, where Terry explained with Paul Jensen's office, they videotaped him explaining why he was going to disobey orders.
Right, and I think we've got that.
Was displayed.
I'm going to be playing that in just a
The prosecution
little bit.
Used
yeah.
that to prove it was premeditated, that was their to show that the court-martial panel, which is like they call it the panel, it's like the jury, you know, members of the panel, to show that he planned this. That was their reason for showing that. Now, we were shocked that the prosecution showed this because that particular video was very powerful. That Terry Lakin in that video is the one I should have seen in the courtroom, but I didn't see it. He was humble and quiet all the time. I think his counselor told him to do that.
Now let's go to day two. In day two, this was the day that the defense was supposed to present its case, and the Neil Puckett, the attorney for Terry Lakin, stood up and said, "The defense rests."
Exactly.
So
and we were
then
all shocked.
What happened? After the shockwave must have just, you know, gone through the entire courtroom. What then? What happened then?
Well, then the judge procedures and things are announced, and they go. The panel has to go out and decide if he's guilty or innocent of moving missing movement, and they go out and they deliberate, and they find him guilty. And then after
I'm sorry. I want to jump in here because I want to add something here. You've said in previous interviews that you learned that Lieutenant Lakin had been questioning Obama's eligibility for over 2 years.
That's right.
And that
he
really did go through chain of command. Tell us what you know about that.
Well, there's a formal procedure to question the leadership in your chain of command, and that's called an Article 138. And he did that. He wrote letters to his elected officials. He also tried to avail himself of what soldiers in the military can do when they feel that there's something wrong and they need help to get it resolved because the military system is not helping them. It's called a request for a congressional inquiry. He mm-hmm. tried that. They didn't even answer him for any of this thing. He just got no answers.
So not even from his elected representatives?
No, none. No answers back. None. Same thing that happened to me.
He tried to use. He tried to get to your elected representatives. No response. No nothing.
No responses.
He
nothing.
And then he used a
now we found out why now, because the Congress was told by that CRS memo, you know, basically the fix was in. The Congress wasn't going to answer people that knew what they were talking about. And if they thought they could buffalo you, they gave you some nonsense answer. But
right.
In the case of myself and Lieutenant Colonel Aiking, they did not answer us. We didn't even get a form letter.
Wow.
So this is a disgrace. So I learned that he had been fighting as long and hard as I had and been treated exactly the same way inside the military as I was being treated outside. Total no interest, no response by the elected officials, in his case also the military, in my case whoever I wrote to, I didn't get an answer. Whoever he wrote to, he didn't get an answer. They're just a stonewall.
Let me ask you this. Do you know who the elected officials were that he contacted, that he tried to get help from?
I don't know their names. You'd have to contact
his trustees
and advisors. He lived in Woodbine, Maryland.
I would
Maryland,
imagine
so,
that.
Woodbine, Maryland.
Maryland,
so
right.
Yeah. You could look it up, who has the district of Woodbine, Maryland. But,
right.
Anyway, at certain
and
point,
who are
though,
your,
also,
who were the elected Who were the elected officials that you contacted that didn't respond to you either?
Well, my congressional representative was named Charlie Dent, and he was a Republican. And my senator was Arlen Specter. No, there you go, Arlen Specter.
There you go. Yeah.
The rhino.
There you go.
But he's on a judiciary committee.
Yeah.
He knew darn well what I was asking about. He's a lawyer, you know. And the other one was Senator Casey. Not a Democrat. I didn't expect anything back from him, but for Senator Specter, a Republican, I thought he would answer me. He didn't. Then I wrote to
and
John
here
McCain.
You are.
I wrote to Senator McCain.
Did.
Never answered me. I wrote to I have to go through the list. There's probably a couple dozen of them. All the key leaders of the various committees. I wrote to people like, you know, Michelle Bachmann. All the people that you thought would be interested, never got an answer. No answer. Everybody is ignore people. But the letters I wrote were 5-page letters. They were well documented as to everything I had done to try to get this vetted.
Sure,
this was prior to me suing. This was prior to my lawsuit. I wrote these letters. I wrote to the President of the United States. I wrote to the Vice President, Chairman of Homeland Security, Chertoff, Secretary, rather.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Terry had been doing the same thing. He had been doing the same thing. I just didn't know it. Everybody thinks he just stood up arbitrarily in March of 2010 and says, I'm not going to Afghanistan. No, he had spent a year and a half prior to that trying to get the question answered, is Obama constitutionally eligible to be the commander-in-chief? He didn't believe
and
he was.
Even his own chain of command, his direct commander, and all the way on up, nobody answered him. What did they
say
to him? Shut up and do your job, or
to paraphrase it, I think they just kind of shrugged and looked at him. You know what I mean? Like nobody wanted to touch this with a 10-foot pole, like a hot potato. They gave him no real answer. If any kind of paraphrase type answer was. Can't help you. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wanted to touch it.
Now,
he was like pushed aside, like boy, this guy's, you know, we don't want to be bothered with him. I think everybody's worried about their career. Anybody who would try to help him would go down with him.
So this means that the courts, the Congress, his state legislators, the military, the media, had closed off every avenue that he had for redress of grievance here.
Right.
He had nowhere to go. They really boxed him in.
He looked at his oath and says, do I give up or do I try to force the system to get attention to this by refusing the orders from Obama, who I consider to be an illegal president? And that's what he chose to do. He basically fell on his sword to call attention to the fact that we have an illegal president sitting in the office ordering 30,000 troops to go to Afghanistan.
Oh, incredible. Just
so
incredible.
The man, in effect, well, you want to say martyred himself, to try to get some national attention on this issue, because nobody was paying attention to him inside the military.
Yeah.
His elected officials in Congress, the people who are tasked to respond to congressional inquiries filed by soldiers, didn't respond to him, didn't answer him. That's the most shocking charge that I heard, that the requests for congressional inquiries filed by a soldier were ignored.
But an officer.
Yeah,
an officer.
They were ignored. I think this all goes to the basic conclusion, Andrea, is that they know the answer, they just don't want to face the truth. They all know that Obama is not eligible, but nobody wants to step up to the plate and face the issue head on. That's why nobody was answering anybody. They know the truth. They can't handle the truth.
I've heard that line before.
Yes.
Jack Nicholson. Yeah.
Yes.
But
anyway, I just wanted to recount when you asked about Reverend Manning. You know, he did arrive at a certain point, and I did notice that wherever he sat, there was these constables or bailiffs in military uniforms sitting to the left and right of him. And at some point, I also noticed there was always three sitting behind me. I think they had certain people flagged. I think they knew who we were.
And they didn't want any trouble.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We were marked because we were potential trouble. But anyway, at one of the recesses, a couple of these security people come in, and they drag Reverend Manning out and charge him with trespassing. We find out a couple hours later that he was incarcerated in an interrogation room, and he was interrogated, and two people from his congregation with him were in separate interrogation rooms, and he was being charged with trespassing. And his car was searched, and he was waved onto the gate by the guard. He was granted permission to come on the base. They said he went through the wrong gate, but he had come through the same gate the day before in the afternoon. So I refresh my memory. I guess he did get there in the afternoon of the first day. So he said that he told the truth. When you're telling the truth, the story always thrives. So hour after hour, they're comparing the stories of all two of his congregational members that came with him and him, and it always was the same. Their car was searched, and they were waved through. They did not trespass. They tried to get him to sign statements that whatever was in him, I don't know. He refused to sign any statements. They finally, after about 2 or 3 hours, left him go, and he rejoined us in the courtroom. But he let it be known that there's going to be his civil rights were violated. Now, there is the only black attendees in the gallery. They're supporting Lieutenant Colonel Lakin. The only black people in the audience, patriots like everybody else, and they're dragged out and charged with trespassing. Said they went in the wrong gate and were therefore trespassing when the guard in that gate left them through. And there were about a dozen other people in that room, white people, who weren't dragged out, who came through the same gate with the same day, the same gate, and the same guard searched their cars and left them through. Now, what kind of a system do we have that he was targeted? I think because they knew his name, and you know how he calls Obama a long-legged Mac Daddy and all that, and he's very, very outspoken. I think he was targeted for harassment.
Could be. That could
and
very
I,
well
I noticed
be.
There was one bailiff watching me on standing on the side all the time, always eyeballing. Every time I look over there, he's looking at me. And there's three guys sitting there. They were waiting for me to do something, I think, to give them an excuse, too. I don't know. But that was very, very – so the only people that were dragged out was Reverend Manning, and there were the three black people. I don't know. Why? Why did that happen? They accuse our side, the R word, right? But look at what they did. They picked the three black people in the gallery who are patriots and drag them out and interrogate them for 2 or 3 hours. What's going on with our country?
That's a good
also
question.
During this recess, they accused us of being potentially violent. One of the old butts who happens to be a lawyer and a military officer in the Marine Corps Reserves assaulted me. You heard about
assaulted
that?
Assaulted you?
Yes,
no.
Assaulted me. Colonel Sullivan. Did you hear the stories on the internet about Colonel Sullivan assaulting?
Lieutenant Colonel Dwight Sullivan, a JAG lawyer. Yes,
yeah,
I have.
He's a full colonel, I think. But he was during a recess. An attorney by the name of William Baer was debating him on the 14th Amendment, because they're always saying the 14th Amendment is one of the grounds that grants Obama natural born citizenship. That and the Wong Kim Ark case, they intellectually dishonestly argue that those things are granting natural born citizenship status to Obama when there's nothing in the 14th Amendment. The word natural born isn't even in there. But anyway, he was debating this with William Baer, and I was two rows away, and I was overhearing this, and I just sort of leaned over the row a little bit and said, the word natural born are not even in the 14th Amendment. And he said something back to me, and I said, well, for you to keep arguing that the 14th Amendment grants natural born citizenship when the words natural born aren't even in the 14th Amendment is intellectually dishonest. And at that point, he blew his cork. He got up out of his chair, face was red, started quickly moving down the row. You know how in a movie theater you have to move around people's knees because the rows are tight? That's the way it was. He almost trampled over two women to get to the side aisle, and he's yelling, "Sir, sir, sir," all the way. And my row was empty towards the wall aisle, so I moved over there because this guy was coming at me hot and heavy. And yelling, "Sir, sir, sir." And he ran up to me. Did you ever see the movie Full Metal Jacket?
Yes.
How the Marine Corps drill instructors stick their face right in your face and try to break down the recruits. Did you ever see that movie or another movie that they do that? He came running up to me, full bore, in a physically intimidating, threatening manner, face flushed red, I mean, bristling. Marine colonel, you know, with a high five haircut and all that, and he stuck his face right in my face and said, "You will not call me dishonest." You know, and I'm standing there like, hey, this guy's not going to intimidate me. So I just looked him right back in the eye. I mean, I'm 33 years in the military, a commander, led men in the military, led men in civilian life. I practiced in the martial arts, the mixed martial arts, judo, taekwondo. I've dealt with physical confrontations many, many, many times. And also with angry people, whatever. I said, this guy is not going to intimidate me. I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to eyeball me and intimidate me. You couldn't win a debate, so you're trying to physically intimidate me. So I just stared him right back in the eye, and he was toe-to-toe, eyeball-to-eyeball. And I said back to him, I did not call you dishonest. I called you intellectually dishonest. But when this happened, he came running up to me, that these constables or bailiffs were going, ho, 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 you know, like something's coming down, and they were just watching. Mm-hmm. And this happened all in about 30 or 50 seconds, and he said, I called you intellectually dishonest. And he says, I'm not dishonest. And I said, well, you are when you apply the 14th Amendment grants natural born citizen. And he says, I never said that. I said, well, you say it on your blog all the time. And I said, I read your stuff. You're doing it all the time, and you're doing it over there. And this is paraphrasing the conversation. But he was really hot, and he's in my face. And at a certain point, I said, I got to take charge of this. This man is trying to bluff me. He's trying to physically intimidate me. And I said, I got to start asking him some questions and turn the tables on him. And that's what I did. I said, tell me. I said, do you or do you not believe that he, being Obama, is a natural-born citizen? I went right to the base of it, right? And he said he wouldn't answer me. He wouldn't answer me. And that's when I knew he was being intellectually dishonest, because if he couldn't answer that question, he had doubts himself, but yet he's arguing that he is, right? So I'm staring him right back at him, and he's staring right at me, right eyeball to eyeball. And I saw him starting to twitch. And looking at his eyes, I could see he's all bluff. He's a hollow man. There's nothing there. So he didn't answer me, so I waited another second or two, and I said real loud, I said, do you or do you not believe he is a natural-born citizen? And at that point, I mean, the guards were all going, hoo, you know, something's going to happen here. Because I was turning the tables on him now, and that's when he started to shake. I could see his eyes twitching, his skin starting to twitch, His body started shaking. He abruptly, he never answered me, he abruptly turned around and ran back to his seat, picked up his book, his tablet, and his pen, and he started to try to write something, and I looked, I observed him, and his hand was shaking like a leaf. He couldn't write.
Oh, ha. Huh.
So
that you called his bluff.
Yeah, he tried to break me, and I broke him. And he has no truth in his side. He's hiding behind his tough Marine Corps colonel veneer, but he's not inside. He knows he's not being truthful. His argument is hollow, just like he is. And the truth, I was arguing the truth, and he knew it, and he broke and he ran.
Yeah, was he one of the
but anyway,
members
but I wanted,
of the
point
the
is,
prosecution
we were accused,
team?
I was going to say, just finish up. We were being accused of potentially being violent, and who's violent again? Who's potentially violent again?
Yeah.
The OBUTs running up to us.
Right.
The lawyer said, Charles, that's physical, that's a technical assault. He didn't batter you, but that's assault. If you want to bring charges on this, I'll be your witness. But I'm not going to pursue that. You know,
Right. It was Colonel Sullivan a member of the prosecution team?
No, but he did know him, and they knew him.
Okay.
They were talking to the and not only the prosecution team but the defense team. Now, can you Neil Puckett and the JAG officer knew Colonel Sullivan very well. And at some point, somebody saw a member of the defense team give Colonel Sullivan or this partner there named Philip Cave, another super OBUT, who's also an attorney, a CD. Now, what was on it, I don't know. But no electronic equipment was allowed in the courtroom. And here, the defense team passes a CD to the two OBUTs that are in the room.
Oh,
so we're there. What's going on here?
Well, didn't you also say that? Maybe I'm jumping ahead here, but the prosecution showed the video of Colonel Lakin talking into the camera about why he did what he did. Did they do that during the closing arguments, the final arguments?
I think it was during the. I have to look at my notes now. I think it was during the sentencing phase. They wanted to show premeditation.
Okay, that's right. You did mention that. That's right. Which is ironic because in it he talks about the whole reason why he's doing it. So I mean, there it was in the courtroom.
Now, wait a minute.
I looked.
It was on the 15th, the second day, at about 3 o'clock. They put it on. And this was in the, I believe it was in the sentencing phase, but, you know, don't get me, I'm almost sure it was in the sentencing phase at that point. But they put it on to show the premeditation, that they wanted to get the maximum sentence.
Yeah, and the irony of it is that the whole reason for Colonel Lakin doing what he did was on that video.
Yes, and after the video was done,
they wouldn't allow it as evidence, but
yeah,
at the same time, it was on the record.
Yeah, I know, and the defense wouldn't use it, but the prosecution did. And when it was done, the audience applauded, and the judge had to like rap the gavel and tell the gallery, she calls the gallery, to be quiet.
Yeah. I want to talk with you about the second day, or maybe it was the third day, when Neil Puckett himself, his own defense attorney, turned on him.
That broke him down. Yep. When he came to the sentencing phase, Neil allowed Lieutenant Colonel Lakin making. An unsworn statement, which is not subject to cross-examination. And I thought this was going to be used, and the gallery thought it was going to be used, to present his arguments that he did this to live up to his oath to the Constitution, and that this would be a positive opportunity for Lieutenant Colonel Lakin to show why he did this. And that's not what Neil Puckett did. He used this to demoralize and throw under the bus Lieutenant Colonel Lakin's honor, self-esteem, and the United States Constitution. He kept beating away at verbally as only an expert attorney is capable of doing when you have somebody on the stand. They can tear you apart. That's what he did. Like you would expect him to be doing this to a hostile witness. He drew an analogy and said that Terry, you're a doctor, and he drew the analogy of cancer. He says you find out you have cancer, and you go to doctor says you have cancer, and you go to another doctor says you don't have cancer, but you refuse to give up on your belief that you have cancer, and so you become obsessed that you have cancer, and you keep doing things, wrong things to get treatment when you don't really have the cancer. And he says, this is the analogy of the Constitution. You believe that there was a cancer on the Constitution, that you know that he called Obama a native-born citizen. Not, he didn't even use the term natural-born. You felt that that he wasn't eligible, but other people told you were wrong, but you didn't want to believe it because you have this obsession with the Constitution. You're obsessed with it. He had the picture of his children on the wall, and the family's in the first row, and he's saying, when are you going to stop thinking of yourself and the obsession to the Constitution and start thinking of his children up here on the wall? When are you going to do something for them instead of for yourself? Can you imagine this? Half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour of this, browbeating him, intimidating him, cross-examining him as he's Terry. After half an hour of this, looked like, you ever see a picture of a Vietnam War prisoner that's been beaten up and mentally duressed to the point that they don't know what they're doing and they're forced to make statements on TV, their heads down and broken? That was Terry.
It makes you want to cry.
It did.
Oh my God.
People in the audience were crying. Neil Puckett ambushed him on the stand. He posted in his own blog that he surprised Terry. Terry did not know what he was going to do. He wanted Terry to show remorse. He wanted Terry to show remorse to get a lesser sentence, but he didn't just make Terry show remorse. He destroyed Terry. He said that you're upset that the cancer on the Constitution was a mirage. A mirage. In other words, his oath and belief in the Constitution that Obama has a question of his eligibility, that's a mirage. There is no cancer in the Constitution, and you're just obsessed with this, and you wouldn't let it go to the point of hurting your own children and your own family. And are you going to stop thinking of yourself now and think of your children? He's pointing at the picture of those three young children on the wall with his wife. I mean, this was mental torture.
Horrible.
Now, you know, if you're under trial for potentially 42 months in prison, you're under a lot of stress already, right?
Yes.
He was under tremendous stress, and his own defense counsel is tearing him apart, destroying him, making him look like he's a selfish individual, only thinking of himself, and pursuing a made-up mirage obsession that there's some threat to the Constitution.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. You must have just wanted to get up and scream, stop.
I was shaking my head. I couldn't understand why. I said, why did they hire this attorney? He doesn't believe. I found out later that this Neil Puckett and the Obama attorney, Colonel Sullivan, who's an ACLU lawyer, by the way, in Baltimore, where he was, and then he was hired by the government to defend the Gitmo terrorists. Did you know that? Colonel Sullivan defended the Gitmo terrorists. But anyway, they're good. They owe each other. They respect each other. But the worst case is that Neil Puckett does not believe in the natural born citizen argument at all. He thinks that if you're native born, you're eligible. And he believes that Obama's native born. He used the term native born. He didn't use the term natural born to describe Obama as the eligibility requirement for Obama. He said he made Terry admit at some point. Now do you believe that Obama's native born or not? Yes or no? And he made Terry say yes. All on the basis of supposedly show remorse and that he's never going to do this again, so that the panel would give him a lighter sentence. But he could have defended Terry using the Constitution as the reason he did this. Not destroy him completely. I think Terry was thought that possibly if Neil if he allowed Neil to do what he wanted to do, that he could maybe stay in the service. That was the most important thing to Terry, is be able to stay in the service. He loved the Army. And I think maybe Neil said, basically, that there's a possibility I can keep you in the service if you show remorse. But he didn't tell Terry at all. He says in his own blog, Neil Puckett says, that he surprised his own client on the stand with his method of questioning.
What an arrogant,
and that to me is an ambush. That's an ambush. And it goes back to how did Lieutenant Colonel Lakin get introduced to this attorney? The attorney who does not believe in the natural born citizen eligibility issue at all, and he believes that all you have to be is born in America. Anchor babies can be president.
Was he set up?
I guess that's the question. Looking at what I saw, it went through my mind. How did this man get to be in a position to talk to Terry and get impressed to the point that he hired this attorney? Because this attorney has a very good reputation as being an expert in UCMJ. But the other thing is now, okay, the sentencing phase is not over, and Neil announces he has to leave early. He left before the case was finished, and he left Now, if what kind of attorney who's 110% committed to your client leaves before the case is finished?
Somebody who's not.
So that makes me think that he did not have himself 110% engaged in defending Terry Lakin. And remember, he said prior to the court martial that Terry is going to be convicted. Remember that statement?
Mm-hmm.
Neil Puckett said to the press someplace or whatever that Terry's going to be convicted. There's nothing, you know.
Yeah.
I think he did.
I think he made that statement because Judge Lind wouldn't allow any evidence in.
Right.
And wouldn't allow him to bring forward any witnesses to defend him in his defense.
Right. I just wonder how much preparation and back room work was done to get ready for this to defend Lakin because he didn't really believe.
As far as he was concerned.
He didn't believe in what Terry stood for.
He didn't believe
in what Terry stood for, the Constitution's limited
oath. What a miscarriage.
As the prime directive.
What a miscarriage.
Why give our officers the oath to defend and support the Constitution if you're not going to do it when you question an order being unconstitutional?
That's right.
There should have been an all-stop order issued when his question came up through the chain of command and says, this officer questioned the constitutionality of this order. We must, you know, the chain of command should have sent a request over to Congress or whatever to get this investigated, to get this issue addressed. Because this officer attempted to live up to his oath.
What does this tell you about the state of our military?
Down in Washington, D.C. is compromised to political correctness extreme and political worrying about their careers more than anything else. They are just totally enveloped with that cesspool down in D.C. like everybody else is. Now you get further
away.
You get away from. You get away. No. I think you get away from D.C. The military is different. You get away from that politics and the guys that are shining their one star waiting for their second star and playing the political game.
Right.
So.
When I was on
active duty for training, I never wanted to go to Washington, D.C. I hated it down there because it's all politics.
Yeah. Well, I understand. But his chain of command all the way down to his next, his closest commanding officer didn't rise to his request for.
Right, but he was stationed at Walter Reed, you know, right in the middle of the Washington, D.C., Baltimore, you know. Beltway down there, you know what I mean? All those people there are politically thinking. They didn't want to touch what he was talking about with a 10-foot pole because they didn't want to be dragged down with him because they knew the system was going to attempt to crush Terry Lakin. Now, if more people would have stood up, the system couldn't have crushed him. But because he stood up and was left alone, nobody helped him, he got crushed.
And this is the lesson to everybody else who's even thinking about doing it.
They threw Terry, his oath to the Constitution and the Constitution itself under the bus. That's what Neil Puckett did. Neil Puckett threw Terry, his oath to the Constitution, and the Constitution under the bus. Just all in an attempt to get him a lighter sentence, he destroyed Terry Lakin. Destroyed him. As only a smart, sharp lawyer can do when you have a humble man like that on a stand,
mm-hmm.
on a high-stress
mm-hmm.
situation like that, he destroyed him. But I tell you this, we shall not hold Terry Lakin in any less esteem for what happened, because he was ambushed, and it's just like when you're faced, and if you were surrounded in World War II, if you were overrun, say at the Battle of the Bulge, your unit's overrun, and you're out of ammunition, you're out of food, and you fought for 3 days to hold the enemy back, and now you have no ammunition, and you're surrounded by 12 Germans with rifles pointed at you, and all you have left is your rifle with a bayonet, no ammunition, and they tell you to surrender. You're faced with overwhelming firepower and support. Do you surrender, or do you charge in with a bayonet and get shot down? Now, if you have the picture of your children being displayed on the wall, surrender or be shot,
mm-hmm.
and you can live to see your children.
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, this mental duress for an hour. He was beat up by the person who was sent to defend him. So he surrenders. Do we hold the soldiers who were captured and surrendered in World War II and made prisoners of war any less heroic because they fought the good battle from Normandy for 3 months and they had to surrender due to overwhelming force at some point? No, they're heroes, right? So
right.
is Terry.
That's right.
He fought the good battle,
yeah.
but he was ambushed. Yeah. He was defeated. He was torn apart by his own defense counsel. So he surrendered.
Yes.
His children were being displayed in the wall. His mother and father. His father's in a wheelchair, sitting in the front wall. The defense attorney's pointing at them. Why did you start thinking of your family? Why did you start thinking of your children, pointing at the wall, those cherubs up there, instead of yourself and your obsession with the Constitution? He broke them. He broke them, man. But Terry is a hero to me. I looked at a man like a prisoner of Al-Qaeda that was being threatened to have his head cut off, or the Vietnam prisoners, they were subject to mental torture.
Mm-hmm.
and forced to say
mm-hmm.
things they didn't want to say. That's the way I looked at Terry. He was broken, and he was forced
yeah.
to say things he really didn't believe, because he, you know, he'd have been sent to 42 months in prison, and he was being told, if you say this, you're thinking of your children, and if you don't, you're not thinking of your children.
Oh, this is horrific. As somebody in our chat room has just noted, Lakin is America. This is war.
Mm-hmm.
Obama must go. Oh,
Obama,
a
commander is always supposed to be thinking of his soldiers, his troops first. You put their interests first, right? That's what you're taught.
Yes.
As a commanding officer.
Mm-hmm.
Obama is the commander in chief. Why is he putting the interests of his army and his soldiers first? Why does he have to destroy a soldier who served 18 years, a doctor, a valued asset? Showed a darn birth certificate, the long form birth certificate. That's all Lieutenant Colonel Lakin wanted to see. The original birth certificate with the signatures, the name of the hospital. He wasn't even going to the natural born arguments of the father's citizenship. He just wanted to see the birth
yeah.
certificate.
Yeah.
Why didn't Obama support his troops and show his original birth certificate? The contemporaneous 1961 typed long form birth certificate. A real birth certificate, not a digital image that lives only as bits and ones and zero in cyberspace that nobody of any controlling legal authority has ever seen the alleged underlying piece of paper
mm-hmm.
used to make a digital
mm-hmm.
image, because I believe the paper was made from the image, not the other way around.
But, you know, the whole point here is that it doesn't matter. It's almost a moot point about the birth certificate, because his father was not an American citizen,
yes.
period.
Yes, I agree. I agree, and you know what? I talked to Terry about that the day before the trial, and I explained to him the argument. And afterwards, he said, you know, nobody ever explained that to me in that way before. And he was starting to see the point. But he got involved initially 2 years ago because he wanted to see the birth certificate. He didn't believe Obama had presented conclusive evidence. He's a doctor.
Yeah.
I think he's delivered babies. He knows what a real birth certificate looked like. Now, oh, that's another point. During the meeting for the 2.5 hours at his home, one of his daughters was born in Hawaii. Either one of his children, his daughter or one of his two sons. So he breaks out their birth certificate, and we start saying, let me see that seal. And we looked at the seal on that Hawaiian certificate, a genuine one, and compared it to the image on the internet that was Obama's seal, which is looked like gibberish. You can't read the state of Hawaii clearly or anything. And Terry said, you're right, it does look different. So all this news that came out about the seals looking different and all that, mm-hmm. We were there looking at it. It was an actual certificate from Hawaii for one of his children, because he was stationed there when they were born. And he's saying, you know, he's shaking his head. So right there and then, he's convinced again that the evidence that he's putting, that Obama's putting on the internet, is forged. It's false. It's not real.
He must have a lot to hide to be doing all of this, spending close to $2 million in legal fees to keep any of this from coming to the court.
Obama is a total forgery. He's a total forgery. I believe he was born not in Hawaii, possibly, probably in Kenya, maybe in Canada, some say, but not in the USA, and at his birth in Hawaii was falsely registered by the grandmother simply to get him a U.S. citizen. The straw man that they were trying to plan for him to be a president for 47 years in advance, that's a straw man argument that the Obuts put up. Nobody on our side ever said that. We simply said there was false registration to simply get him a U.S. citizenship. How many cases of document fraud do we see today of people trying to become U.S. citizens? It occurs thousands of times a day.
Yeah.
And the Mexican border, people walk across the border. Hawaii, they come in from Asia because of the lax rules on getting citizenship. Two people can swear you were born in Hawaii, and they give you a certification of live birth.
Mm-hmm.
I think Grandma Dunham signed it saying he was born at home with no witnesses. Send it in as a mail-in form. Bingo, bango, he's registered. And because of the registration, it appeared on that list that week in the two newspapers because that was automatic from the state. Document, falsified registration, fraud. And his whole life
Fraud. there's not a spine in Congress, with the exception of Bill Posey, my representative, who drafted that legislation that would require any candidate running for president to present certification of their eligibility under the Article 2, Section 1. And
did he get reelected? Did he get reelected?
Yes, he did. Yes,
he
did.
Is he going to reintroduce it? Is he going to reintroduce the bill?
I don't know.
Well, I hope so.
I don't know.
Because now there will be a Republican committee chairman, and they can maybe get it out of committee.
Yes, but I'll tell you, the grief that he took just for presenting that legislation, and of course it died with this Congress. It went nowhere. I think he had maybe 11 or 12 co-authors, co-sponsors on it. That was it.
Right.
They didn't
have it
on third rail. They didn't want to touch it.
Absolutely, and that's the way it was with the chain of command with Lieutenant Colonel Lakin. It's the third rail. Nobody wants to touch this question. And why? Because they all know there's a question of his eligibility. They know the answer. He's probably not eligible. Everybody knows it, but nobody wants to touch it. Why? Because of the fear of civil unrest that the far left has whispered in the hallways and say, oh, you can't do this. First of all, during the election primary, if you brought it up, you were being charged with a racist. You're a racist. But now after it's a fait accompli and a legal a usurper is in the office now. Oh, you can't get them out of there now. There'll be riots. You know, I don't really believe there would be that much civil unrest, and it can be handled because you're supporting the Constitution. The people, white, black, green, or purple, are going to stand up for the Constitution if the controlling authorities subpoena the documents and show there's no proof he was born in Hawaii. His father's not a citizen. He's not a natural born citizen. End of story. Get out. He's ineligible. Undo everything he did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Oh, happy day. Wow.
Right. Well, you and I that he's not eligible because his father is not a U.S. citizen, was never even an immigrant. That minister that got up at the Inauguration Day speech and said that he was a son of an immigrant, was telling a falsehood. His father was not an immigrant to America. His father had no interest in America. His father didn't even like America. He was a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist. He went back to Africa to try to convert Kenya to Marxism. He didn't even have a green card. He wasn't even a permanent resident.
And given all of that, there's still some doubt. There's still question as to whether or not Obama Sr. really is his father. I mean, there are people who maintain that he was paid to say that he was the father.
The birth date is even in question. That's probably the birth date that Grandma Dunham put down as him being born. If the narrative that best explains it to me is that she went as a 17, 18-year-old girl in the second trimester over carrying the child to Kenya to give it up to the family over there, and was supposed to leave a child there with a paternal family and then come back and start a life over in college with minus the child. You know, in the 60s, many, many people went away to take the child, a young girl got pregnant. They sent them away to Aunt Matilda, which was really an adoption center, and they had the baby there, and they come back and start their college and start their life. I think that's what was going on, because whether or not he was legally, biologically the father, everybody believed it, and I think she went over there to give up the baby, but couldn't. Maternal instincts kicked in, but I think he was born in July, not in August, and it gave her plenty of time to come back by steamship with the child, because they have doctors on board. She could have traveled easily on a steamship and transited from Kenya back to either Seattle or maybe to Vancouver, Canada, and came across the border by ferry, you know, and started her school with an infant, because, you know, the stories out of there that she didn't even know how to change a diaper right when she got back.
Right.
Even his birth date is in question. There's nothing about this man that's for certain. Nothing. There's no independent facts to verify anything about this man.
Oh, boy. And in the meantime, Terry Lakin sits in a cell at Leavenworth for 6 months.
Now, I did hear from an insider over the grapevine type, over the law, that when he arrived there, they knew that this was a special person coming. And all the higher-ups of the prison out there were there to make sure that he was processed properly and treated fairly and all that kind of thing. And it's almost like a VIP prisoner coming in. I mean, the top staff was there. And the person, you know, I cannot in any way say how I got this information, you know, could be from an inmate, could be from, you know, family of an inmate, could be from somebody else that works there or whatever, you know what I mean, as a friend of somebody. But anyway, there was a story leaked out that he was treated as a VIP prisoner coming in. Everybody knew about him and what he did and what he stood up for. And there's a story that a lot of people there believe what he did was right.
There's some vindication in that, isn't there?
Right. So the further you get away from Washington, D.C., the more people know what he did is right, what I did is right, that Obama is not eligible. There's questions. 60% of the people have doubts about his eligibility, his birth story, his narrative, his nativity. That's 150, you know, million plus, and that's a fringe.
Yeah.
And yet no controlling legal authority, and a controlling legal authority to me is a court of law with subpoena power or a congressional hearing with subpoena power to get all the documents he's hiding, Occidental College, passports, any kind of paper that we can find to document this man's legal identity. The original birth certificate and amendment. I think there were amendments to that. I think he was legally adopted at age 5 or less, which under the Geneva Conventions would have lost his U.S. citizenship. When you adopt a child under age 5, you're like born again as a citizen of a new country. So I think he's hiding that. I think there was an amendment of his birth records indicating he was adopted at age 5 or less.
By an Indonesian. Yeah. Well, and the other thing too is his family, Terry Lakin's family. Now I know that you're involved in fundraising for the family, because they really don't have any visible means of support, do they?
No, he lost everything. He lost his career, his pension, which is valued at about $2.5 million. You know, the present value of of a lifetime pension as a retiree, as a colonel. Oh. He was selected for colonel. He retired as a colonel. He lost all his pay and benefits immediately. That means no medical care, nothing for him and his family. Gone. Boom. Soup. No money, no pay, no medical benefits, nothing. So I offered to help, do whatever I can to speak out, and their family has set up a trust fund and a website. It's called TerryLakinActionFund.com. LAKIN ActionFund.com. Or you could go to my webpage, www.protectourliberty.org. Protectourliberty.org, and there's a direct link right at the top to Terry Lakin's site to raise funds to help support his family. And I am no longer raising funds for my case, so I'm helping to raise funds to help his family. They need help. He stood up for us. He stood up for our Constitution. He stood up for our liberty, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. He was railroaded. He was ambushed by his own defense counsel. He's in prison now for 6 months. We've got to help him for 6 months at least to help support his family. Now, there is a potential appeal, I think, in process that could somehow get his benefits paid the pay and benefits for those 6 months to his wife. But I understand that's a two-year process. So if he ever does get any money that way under this special exception that he's not getting the pay but his wife, that 6 months' pay may come back 2 years from now. She might be awarded it. But in the meantime, what are they going to eat for the next 6 months? You know what I mean? They need income. Now, the family's going to try to help him, of course. But I think America should help him. He stood up for all of us.
Yes. Yes. Are contributions coming in? I mean, are
yes,
people
they are.
To
yes,
this?
Terry Lake and ActionFund.com. I figure... Now, not counting for legal expenses, his pay and benefits were probably worth about $10,000 a month to him. So that's the goal, to raise at least that much for support of his family, to be able to get health insurance, you know, and get the income coming in for his three children and his pay his mortgage and things like that. I think his pay was around pretty close to $8,000 for a doctor. That's not a lot of money. But... And then the other $2,000 for the medical benefits for the family and things. So, because you have to purchase it separately, it's going to cost you a lot more than when the government was providing it, right? So,
of course, yes.
I just estimate he needs to raise at least $10,000 for 6 months to cover the pay and benefits, the value of them. And then if I don't know what Neil Puckett charged him for that defense,
miscarriage of justice.
That defense, you want to put it in quotes. Well, I have no idea what a Washington D.C. Well-known lawyer charges. What, $700 an hour, $1,000 an hour, and then he was there for 2.5 days because he left early the last day. Like I mentioned, he went off to Sicily or something to defend somebody else. If it's $1,000 an hour, it's 2 days. Billable hours. 9 hours, 18 hours. You know, it could be talking $50,000 easy for his legal fees. Money has to be raised to pay those.
Yeah.
So
let's take a call, Commander Kirshner. We're down to our last 10 minutes, and we've got somebody here who's got their hand raised that would like to ask a question. I think it's probably a Skype or a cell phone caller. But caller, go ahead. You're on the air with Commander Kirshner. Go ahead, caller.
Andrea?
Oh,
hello?
It's Marie. Hello,
hi.
Marie from New York. Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Hear you just fine.
It's really a shame. It's almost like this guy was a plant. You know, I mean, I wasn't too impressed. I had seen him on a video. But it just reminds me of when you had Tim Harrington and J.B. Williams on, and I don't understand why... Hemingway, was it Margaret Hemingway, was the spokesperson?
Well, if I understand it, J.B. Williams and Jim Harrington take credit for getting the
counsel,
Neil Puckett.
You're kidding.
That's what they said in their blogs, that they were responsible for getting Terry Laking first-class counsel.
Oh, I don't know. Because
I'm paraphrasing what I read. I mean, If I'm wrong about that, I'll stand corrected. But they claimed that they were involved with hooking them up.
No, I don't know, because that night they seemed to have a whole different angle on the defense and all. And this is really, how can an attorney do this to a client?
I don't know.
There should be some repercussions for that. You know,
I would have not hired an attorney to defend me who did not absolutely believe in the oath to the Constitution, that the Constitution mm-hmm. is the supreme law of the land, and that all laws and orders need to be judged against that Constitution, and that you're going to defend me on that basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he demeans his whole...
prime directive of every officer prime directive is to defend the Constitution. You know, you go through your whole military career, you never would be asked to defend the Constitution in most normal times. We're not living in normal times. We got people who are throwing the Constitution under the bus with Obama right at the top. But, you know, you normally would be worried about disobeying a law that was involved in committing a crime, say, or something like that. But the Constitution, the oath of the Constitution doesn't tell you what kind of violation of the Constitution you're supposed to support and defend. If you feel that you are being told to do something that's not constitutional, you are supposed to support and defend it. That's what your oath says, so help you God, nothing else. You're not supposed to obey the president. It doesn't say that in there. It says to support and defend the Constitution. And he believed that the Constitution was being violated because Obama was not legally eligible to issue those orders to surge 30,000 troops into combat in Afghanistan. He is not a legal president. So they should have investigated and answered that question, not tried him, put him on court martial for disobeying the orders. He shouldn't have had to go that far. He should have.
No, but his attorney shouldn't have demeaned him like that at the end.
Exactly.
That's
his attorney should have came in and stood up for exactly what Terry was arguing, that the oath to the Constitution, the supreme law of the land, required him to stand up and do what he did.
Yeah, it's very sad.
Hey, Marie, thank you for the call, and thanks for tuning in tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It is. Say a prayer for him and his family, too, for sure. They can
What did Neil get by doing this to Terry? He still got dismissed from the—he didn't save it. He didn't save his client. His client got dismissed from the service, lost all pay and benefits, and maybe he got him 6 months. Maybe there was a plea bargain behind the scene. I don't know. Maybe it would have been a year. Maybe it would have been 18 months instead. But then maybe not. Maybe if he'd argued the constitutionality and said to all those members of the panel, you read your oath. Now read the oath for enlisted man where it says you also have to obey the orders of the president and the officers above you. But the officer's oath doesn't. It says your sole responsibility is to support and defend the Constitution. Ask each of those panel men, look them in the eye. Why? Why? Why is the officer's only charge to defend the Constitution? Because the day was envisioned that a president could be corrupt and violating the Constitution, and you'd have to stand up to him. Your military officers would have to stand up to support the Constitution in face of an illegal usurpation of constitutional powers by a corrupt, wrong, illegal president. They wanted that ability that they were not going against their oath. I would have asked each of them, what would you do if you knew the president was performing an unconstitutional illegal act? And you were ordered to be participating in it. What would you do? Obey the orders? Or
that would have been a great defense.
Yes.
A great defense.
And I don't think if they wanted to railroad him, they would have still dismissed him and given him 6 months in prison. But he'd have left that room with his honor.
Yes. Yes.
I would have asked every witness in the prosecution, read the officer's oath, read the enlisted man's oath. Why is the enlisted man required to obey the officers above him and the president and, of course, support the Constitution? But why are officers only charged to support the Constitution and defend the Constitution? Why? Why the difference? Bring up the Nuremberg situation where people over there said, I was just following orders. You must obey orders. Orders from authorities and the supreme commander, Adolf Hitler, whatever, you know. That's the law. You follow orders. Well, they all were hanged for following orders that were determined to be crimes against humanity. Now, this is a constitutional question. But is our Constitution the supreme law of our land, or isn't it? If it is, you should be judging your orders against all laws of the country, including the Constitution, because your oath requires you to do it. So help you God.
Yeah.
If they don't want the officers to live up to the oath, why don't they get rid of the oath? If they don't want a natural born citizen for the president, amend the Constitution. Don't throw the Constitution and the oath that officers take under the bus. We go potentially to die in support of our country for that oath. The whole country's freedom depends on that Constitution. It's the glue that's held us together for 200 plus years. If they throw the Constitution under the bus and the oath to it, we don't have a military system left. If you're going to be fighting for the defense of a man, a charismatic president, and that's all you're charged to defend and follow orders from him, we're done for.
Yeah.
Especially when you got a man in the Oval Office like Obama.
Oh, amen to
that. That man is not only illegal, that man, I think, is corrupt and immoral, evil.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, we see what he's doing to our country. The fruit of his labor is visible.
Right.
Yeah.
Now they got that don't ask, don't tell put through. That's going to destroy the warrior ethos in the military is going to be destroyed by that. Being forced to accept. You have to be in the military to experience it. There's an ethos there of right and wrong.
Yeah.
And
Having never served, I can only rely on the words of men such as yourself that this is not a good thing for the military, not a good thing for national defense at all.
You look at the Common Core Army values and the ethos of a warrior, and they're destroying it.
We're going to have
tens of thousands of men that will not reenlist and will not enlist because of what they did with repealing that law.
Well, I'm not sure. I'll tell you, I've said it many times, if I had a son or a daughter who wanted to enlist right now under this current commander-in-chief, I would discourage them. I would do everything but turn myself inside out to discourage them from doing it. If they want to do it, let them wait until this president is no longer in office. I wouldn't send my son or daughter to war under this president. No way. No way.
He's illegal.
Commander Kirshner. Yes, I believe he is too. Commander Kirshner, we're just about out of time here. I got about like 3 minutes left. But I wanted to thank you so much, first of all, for coming on the show tonight, and secondly, for being there for Colonel Lakin, and also for your service to the country, not only while you served in the military, but now. I mean, you've never stopped. You've never stopped serving our country, defending her and defending the Constitution. And I have to tell you, it is an honor to know you. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. I look at it this way. He's in prison now. I'm outside. I got his back. I got his back. Soldier to soldier.
Amen.
I got his back. I'm going to cover for him as best I can and speak out because he's not going to be allowed to.
Yeah. All right, Commander Kirshner, thank you again. Thank you. And we'll be in touch. We'll stay in touch. All right, you
take
care.
Thank you for having
me
on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you,
sir. God bless.
Thank you again. God bless you, too. Bye-bye. And again, the website you can go to donate for Terry Lakin's family is terrylakinactionfund.com. I'm sure you can spare a few dollars, send a check, or get over there and use your credit card, whatever it is, and every little bit counts, every little bit helps. He represents all of us, just as Commander Kirshner said. Well, we didn't get a chance to play the clip for you of Colonel Terry Lakin, but I think probably what Commander Kirshner had to say was probably well worth hearing. So we'll leave you with that. Tomorrow night, no show. We'll be back on regular scheduled programming on Monday. And I wish all of you a very happy, safe new year. And while you're ringing in the new year, don't forget Terry Lakin. Don't forget Terry Lakin, okay? All right, everybody. Thanks again so much for being with me tonight. And we'll see you next year, right? Yeah, we'll see you next year. All right, everyone. Take care and good night.
I'm just trying to be a father, raise a daughter and a son, be a lover to their mother, everything to everyone. Up and at 'em bright and early, I'm all business in my suit. Yeah, I'm dressed up for success, from my head down to my boots. I don't do it for the money. There's bills that I can't pay. I don't do it for the glory. I just do it anyway. Providing for our futures, my responsibility. Yeah, I'm real good under pressure, being all that I can be. I can't call in sick on Mondays when the weekend's been too strong. I just work straight through the holidays, sometimes all night long. You can bet that I stand ready when the wolf growls at the door. Hey, I'm solid, hey, I'm steady, hey, I'm true down to the core. And I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost, I know the sacrifice. Oh, and I don't want to die for you, but if dying's asking me, I'll bear that cross with honor, cause freedom don't come free. I'm an American soldier, an American, beside my brothers and my sisters, I will proudly take a stand. When liberty's in jeopardy, I will always do what's right. I'm out here on the front line, sleep in peace tonight. American soldier, I'm an American soldier. Line, sleep in peace tonight, American.